Hello and welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 23. Today we're going to be discussing the sharing economy, which will include such topics as Airbnb, B-Cycle, Lyft, and Uber. Tonight I am joined by Eric Taylor and Lydia Tabbitt. My name is Matt Winter. We've got a bunch of sweet clips to play tonight, and I'd like to ask my friend Eric Taylor to take it away.
Sure. So this is kind of a topic that Lydia brought up a while ago, and as far as a good, a good discussion for a podcast. So it's a sharing economy and various services that take advantage of that. So I'm actually going to slide it over to Lydia, and she can kind of touch on that a little bit, and then we can go through a conversation and various clips.
Okay, so my understanding of what the sharing economy is basically utilizing different things, be it your home or your vehicle, or really kind of anything that you're willing to share, typically through like some sort of mobile application or kind of online networking type of thing to connect with other people interested in renting or borrowing or sharing something with you. So kind of the two big names that I think of when I think of sort of the sharing economy would be like an Uber, Lyft, sort of a car ride sharing type of organization, or Airbnb, so more of like a home rental type of situation. So basically the idea is taking something that you have that you're not utilizing or that you only use part of the time, and having others benefit from it, and you rent it out temporarily. So
how does Uber work?
I wish I could speak from firsthand experience. I really should be able to, but thanks to government regulation, which we'll get into in a bit, the places where I would use it it's currently outlawed, basically, or kind of working underground. So my understanding of Uber is that I've signed on to it and I have an account, but you go on and it tells you sort of who in your area nearby has their application on that is working, and you can kind of contact them. And so it shows kind of who's in your area and that's driving, and then you can kind of select them and request a ride. And I believe also kind of how it works is there's sort of a survey or what's the word I'm looking for? Like review sort of portion where you can kind of evaluate your service for the use or benefit of future riders. So
there's actually like a review service that says, I think this car was awesome, you should hire them, and then there's like the ability to see that when you're trying to get somebody who wants to come pick you up?
I believe so, yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
I have a clip on how it works.
That works.
Oh yeah, no, that's awesome. Let's hear it.
Let's see.
I'm actually a data evangelist for Uber, so I was for Uber's first data science guy back in early 2011, and much to, I think, everybody in this room would probably think I was crazy, knowing that I was the one that was looking at Uber's revenue growth curves. I decided to pull back my work with Uber to go back into academia full time. So I'm also a professor now of computational cognitive science and neuroscience at UC San Diego, and I sort of moonlight with Uber as their data evangelist. So I do a lot of just exploratory data analytics. So Uber lets me play around with some of their data and try and come up with new and interesting ways of looking at it. My research is actually, I look at brain networks. How does a brain talk to itself? The brain is an inherently noisy environment. And how do we extract meaning out of that noise? And I promise you this is actually relevant for retail and business. So I'm very interested in how the different brain regions communicate. And to give you an example of how powerful our ability to pull signal out of noise is, I'm going to play something that's very annoying Hopefully the sound works. I apologize. It's a sentence that I've taken most of the meaningful information out of. I've filtered out all of the meaning of the sentence, so it's going to be very annoying, but try and hear what is being said.
She writes to her brother every day.
Really annoying. I apologize. So
something about a brother every day?
Something every day. So if I actually do an experiment with a whole bunch of people, people get about 2 words correct on average. So here's that same exact sentence now, but unfiltered, so normal.
She writes to her brother every day.
Okay, now I'm going to play the exact same filtered sentence that you heard the first time.
She writes to her brother every day.
Does it sound qualitatively different? The first time and the third time are the same thing. So I've taken all of the data that's relevant for speech, removed most of it from the sentence. Now, one-time experience, or one shot with an unnoisy version of that stimulus, totally changes the way that you perceive that filtered stimulus. And so we are very good, our brains are incredibly good at extracting meaning out of noisy stimuli. And so part of the work that I do with Uber is trying to understand how do you extract meaning out of inherently noisy stimuli in the world. So I don't know if anybody... One of the ways I like to describe this is I don't need to know anything about anyone. I just need to know a little bit about a whole bunch of people. And that becomes very useful. So one of the things that first sort of got my interface with Uber was a paper that my wife and I had actually published where we did data mining on the neuroscientific literature. So my field is very complicated. There's actually about 3 million neuroscientific peer-reviewed publications that in existence. And it got very frustrating to me that there's no way to combine all that information. And so my wife and I worked on this project. The details of the slide don't really matter necessarily, but the idea was, can you find relationships between seemingly disparate topics? So, you know, some brain area we know is involved in some kind of process like hearing, and we know that this neurotransmitter is involved in something like reward, and all these pieces of information are separate. Is there some way that we can use data mining to combine all that into something meaningful? And so we created this website that allows you to visualize, based upon these 3 million peer-reviewed papers, how different topics are related, and then to see if we could find relationships that should exist where none exist. So we actually used essentially Facebook or LinkedIn's friend recommendation algorithm to see if this neurotransmitter serotonin is very related to this brain region called the striatum, and it's also very related to a disease like migraines. Maybe striatum and migraines should be related. So a friend of a friend and a friend of a friend, maybe these guys should be friends. And that was it. It's essentially the exact same algorithm. And this was kind of a big hit, and this sort of opened the door with some of the work for Uber. And in my work with Uber, what I'm really interested in is understanding neighborhood patterns. So in the brain, I'm interested in how does information flow from one brain area to the other in a very noisy environment. And with Uber, I'm very interested in how do people flow in cities. And so one way that we can look at that is breaking down a city into some arbitrary geographic designation. So here we just use neighborhoods that everybody know and love, but we can actually do a number of different computational ways of breaking a neighborhood up. And what you're looking at is the proportion of demand by neighborhoods by hour of week. And so here on the first graph, you can see that within San Francisco, the financial district and the Mission have very different temporal profiles. The Mission goes crazy on weekends, not as much action on the weekdays, whereas the financial district, you can see you got a morning and an evening bump, and not as big on Saturday and Sunday. And so this tells you a little bit about something about the way that people are using Uber within the city and how they're using Uber within these neighborhoods. And what's interesting to me is that the financial district in New York and the financial district in San Francisco look very similar to one another, more so than these two neighborhoods within the same city. So this tells you that there are similarities across neighborhoods that are in totally different cities. And we can actually quantify the relationship, how similar these different neighborhoods are across, at the time, all the neighborhoods that we had, and visualize them and see how do all these different neighborhoods relate. And this is actually an interactive graph that you can play with online. But what you can pull out of this is that cities are heavily interconnected with one another. So the financial district in New York and the financial district in San Francisco are more alike than the Mission and the financial district are within the same city. And in fact, the Mission looks a lot like Williamsburg in Brooklyn, but not as much like the financial district. And so by looking at these demand patterns, you can basically extract features and say, okay, the Mission is a party weekend neighborhood, and the financial district is a workday neighborhood. This tells you something about how people are using our service in these different neighborhoods. Again, not knowing anything about how any one person, just the aggregate demand patterns that we have in these different neighborhoods. And we can actually plot that within a neighborhood. We can say, for any given neighborhood in a city, what is the probability that if you start a ride in one neighborhood, you're going to the other neighborhood? So within San Francisco, if you start a ride in the SoMa, you're much more likely to go to the financial district or downtown than you are to going to, like, Outer Sunset, right? And so this tells you a little bit about the way people are moving. It tells you about a city's flow. Not only when are people moving around a city, but where are people going? And we can actually break these things down into something that allows you to give a demand prediction on a neighborhood-by-neighborhood basis. So if somebody starts in one neighborhood, where are they probably going to go? And using this information, we can then optimize the algorithms that reduce pickup times. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, what people want when they open Uber is a car very quickly. But not too quickly, it turns out. So when I first started working at Uber, the average pickup time in San Francisco was about 15 minutes. Now the average pickup time in San Francisco is about 2. And one of the ways that we do that is by knowing some of these kinds of details. But it turns out that if you actually look at...
That's crazy!
If you open the app, what is the probability that they take a ride, request a car, based upon the estimated time of arrival? Of course, as the estimated time of arrival decreases, the number of people that request a car increases, except for if it's around a minute. That's actually, we like to call it too convenient. You know, like you'll be in your office and you request a car and then you open up the app and the car is like right there on the corner and you're like, oh, I still have to get my stuff together. So you close the app and you're like, so, not really sure what to do about that, but it's a good problem to have. It's an embarrassment of riches. And then we can actually do some other things. So this is that same kind of graph that I showed you, but for Washington, D.C. And this is actually how did demand patterns change as a function of the U.S. government shutdown. So during the couple of days that the government shutdown occurred, what we see is blue means that rides increased between neighborhoods when the government shut down, and red is rides decreased. And what you end up seeing is that between Capitol Hill and most other neighborhoods, suddenly Capitol Hill shut down. People stopped taking rides to and from Capitol Hill during the government shutdown. Not a big surprise, but it's kind of interesting that you can see this in the actual data. And there's a couple of other interesting little patterns that you can pull out of here, but doing analyses like these is kind of fun because you can actually look at these very rare, we call them in the sciences, we call them natural experiments. We can't make people not do certain things, but when something happens to happen, like the government shuts down, that's a natural experiment. We can take advantage of that and see how do patterns change. I'm very excited about the possibilities that we can really go into with the future of data.
That may not have been the best explanation as to what Uber
I was going to say, yeah, it was more about data collection than about the service itself, but still interesting.
Yeah, interesting how they, you know, how they use analytics to you know, allow for...
Improve their service, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for improvement, quick pickup, that type of thing. But what Uber is really about at, you know, is, you know, allowing for drivers or, you know, individuals with vehicles to provide, you know, essentially taxi services out of their car for other people, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I did have a few clips that kind of came from the driver's perspective, because they're really, I think there's kind of a back and forth between taxi lobby, yeah, and Uber, because mm-hmm. Uber has been able to,
and city governments, yeah, are kind of the caught in the middle of it.
Yeah, because the various lobbies are, you know, basically trying to prevent it.
Yeah, protectionism.
Yeah. So I'm going to give one more clip a try, and if hopefully this is better than last. And this is kind of Uber explained from a taxi cab driver's perspective.
Give something else to you.
Right.
Right. They have Uber. They started when they came in the industry. They started with a limo. They called it block car. Then they came up with Uber SUV.
Yeah. Oh, this is done. Sorry.
It was 3 seconds long?
That wasn't the clip I was looking for.
Oh, okay.
So let's see here.
Well, I guess I'd look at the I just look at the entire idea in that anybody can sign up to be a driver for the service. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like a crowdsourced driver's service. If you want to get a little extra money, you can sign up for it. You can drive around in your own personal car, pick people up, bring them to where they need to go. You get a lot of benefit out of doing it. You make some money, and that's phenomenal. I know eventually you could see a situation where you'd see people who were willing to deal with drunk people at the end of the night who'd be charging more, you know. I want to go
home.
Well,
yeah, and that's people do that currently.
Oh, okay. So that's awesome. That's phenomenal that that's available, that you can have this free market kind of influence on a service that's been around for so long. Especially considering that you've got a taxi service out there that directly competes with it, but that taxi service doesn't provide the same service in the aspect that it's not a free market system. You essentially, well, I guess it might be in a little bit of the way, but not nearly as free market as Uber is. Just because you've got a fixed price per mile, and they just show up, they charge you what they do, and you pay what it is when you're done. But now you've got a review with a driver? How awesome is that? I know a lot of people. All right, quick story. A friend of mine was on his way home from downtown Minneapolis to the west suburbs, and he had a bottle of wine with him. It was unopened, and the driver who showed up said, "You cannot bring that into my car. I will not accept that being in my car because it's against my religion." So my friend said, "I don't care. I'm going to get into your car anyway." So he got into his car. The guy started driving him home. Eventually, they met halfway back to home, which was Minnetonka, Minnesota. He was going to Shorewood. And the taxi driver said, "I will not have you in my car anymore." Said, "Get out." So literally on the bridge over 494 on Highway 7, he had these boys get out of the car. Where they're in danger, this isn't a place where there's a sidewalk or anything, and a police car came up, stopped on the side of the road. Cop said, "What is going on?" They explained the situation, what was going on. The cop ended up giving them a ride home to their house. But the story of the Uber influence would be so phenomenal here. That driver was a horrendous driver for somebody who's like a normal American.
So it's a smartphone.
A normal American just trying to find a ride home on a Friday night after they've been drinking, which is, you know, who's going to say that's a bad thing? You're getting a ride home from somebody who's sober. So, yeah, this is phenomenal to me. I love the idea that this service is available.
I did find a good clip over specifically kind of a taxi cab driver's argument against Uber, which seems like it's been getting defeated. It was defeated in Minneapolis, I believe, in Virginia as well. You can kind of get, and I think that's the biggest obstacle against Uber.
Was Uber defeated in Minneapolis? I hadn't heard whether or not it was.
Well, Uber and Lyft can now operate in Minneapolis.
Oh, can they? Okay, I hadn't heard that.
That
recently.
There was a ruling.
I've seen a lot of the cars with the mustaches on the front.
Yeah. That ruling was complete, I think, 2.5 weeks ago.
Okay.
So let's roll this. Hopefully, the second time will be better than the first here.
So smartphones and apps are creating a lot of competition for businesses out there, and now cab drivers are realizing, uh-oh, we might be in trouble.
Uber is the app that we're talking about. It's got a lot of people using their smartphone to get to their destination as they kind of do an end run around taxis. And cab drivers aren't too happy about that, are they, Jeff?
No. Have you guys used this yet?
Have not.
You know, Uber's popularity, it's only increasing. And the San Francisco-based company has plans to expand to other cities. But cab drivers, they're not going down without a fight. They're finding a variety of ways to protest. And in some cases, it's turning violent. For example, this is what happened in Paris. You see those cab drivers blocking traffic there. In the middle of a busy section of a highway leading to the airport, other drivers shattered windows, smashed mirrors, slashed the tires of vehicles from Uber's fleet. Uber is an app that you download on your smartphone. And the way it works is very simple. A map pops up on your phone and shows the location of Uber drivers closest to you. Then you press a button to be picked up. Within seconds, you're notified of which driver accepted that pickup. And while he's en route, you see his picture and other customer reviews about him. And within minutes, he's at your front door in a luxury vehicle. There's no money exchanged. The transaction is done electronically through the app, including the tip. You pay anywhere from 50 to 70% more for the service than a regular cab. But it seems like a lot of passengers are still turning to this service because of the convenience and, of course, the quick response thanks to the GPS locations within the app. But many taxi drivers say this is unfair, including a group who recently protested in Washington, D.C.
The guy that owns Uber lives in San Francisco, California.
It's going to cost me money, number one. Number two, I feel like I'm going to lose my job.
Well, taxi drivers have pushed for lawmakers to step in, and in some cases they have been successful. In Paris, a 15-minute law went into effect, requiring all Uber drivers to wait 15 minutes after a request is placed to pick up a passenger, giving cab drivers an advantage. Other taxi drivers are calling for driver recruitment bans. Now, Uber has fought back against a lot of these policies and proposals, including in Portland, where Uber is trying to convince lawmakers to get rid of an ordinance that calls for a one-hour wait before Uber drivers can go make their pickups.
There's easy enough to get around that. You just call earlier. But Jeff, do you know, do Uber drivers, do they have to pay all the same fees and go through the same regulation as cab drivers?
I'm not sure exactly what the
fees would be, the drivers have to pay.
The company does get a portion of what the drivers collect. And we should also mention there's another app-based company in San Francisco called Cherry, and it's the same concept except with car washes. If you need a car wash, you get on your app, you indicate that you need one, they show up, they wash your car for you. So car washes might be the next thing to face this.
What is keeping cab drivers from getting some kind of an app so they can do the same thing?
You have to keep up. You can't be mad with technology. Yeah. You just have to keep up.
Certainly, you don't want to protest the way that they have done, stopping traffic. That's no way. People aren't going to go for cab drivers if they're going to be doing that.
No. Yeah, I believe that's the same app, though. Very popular in L.A., Jeff.
I bet. And they have plans to expand to a lot of other cities, Kiva.
All right, Jeff Moore, thank you.
Sure.
So,
that's kind of a good point. You'd really have to imagine that taxi companies will come out with something similar, right? I mean, why wouldn't you?
You would think so. To me, the whole thing just really exposes government protectionism of an industry and how a group of employees can affect legislation to kind of influence legislation that helps themselves but hurts the general population or restricts the general population from having access to a different or better way of doing things. I think it just kind of it is exposing more people to kind of the crony capitalism of even just local governments.
Right. And it's kind of, when you're talking about Uber in the sharing economy, it's going on across multiple industries. So some of the topics that we kind of outline were B-Cycle for bicycling or Airbnb, or Lyft and Uber. Cherry was referenced on the clip, which is a way to take care of that type of thing for washing cars. And there's kind of a decentralization of services that's occurring. So rather than going through, if you want to talk about Uber and taxi companies, rather than going through an outfit that owns a bunch of cabs, you no longer need to use that as an intermediary. You just go directly to somebody who owns a car. Or when talking about Airbnb, rather than going through hotel chains, you go directly to individuals that own, you know, whatever property is available where somebody, you know, where they want to go or where they want to stay. So it's like a, you know, an individual to individual type of transaction rather than going, you know, through established businesses. And that seems to be, you know, with the sharing economy, that's kind of what you're talking about. And it's somewhat disruptive. So you get, you know, protectionist pushback from, you know, various.
Well, and there's, and the thing, yeah. The argument that can certainly be made is that there's no reason to believe that because of these applications that the lobbies or, you know, sort of traditional hotels, motels won't still coexist, you know? I know, there's legislation in Madison, Wisconsin, or was, regarding Uber. I believe it was in Madison, Uber and Lyft, being forced to provide service, during off hours. So like 2 or 3 in the morning, because I think there's some sort of policy where Madison taxi companies have to have at least some service available during kind of non-peak hours, mm-hmm. Like 3, 4 in the morning. And there was some sort of legislation on if you're a Lyft or Uber driver, you have to, I don't know, be accessible or kind of sharing that risk or burden or whatever, with the taxi companies. Whereas to me, if you're a taxi driver, then that's your full-time job. You're not, you know, driving for Uber part-time or kind of when you have the availability. To me, that's an opportunity where you could kind of coexist and would not necessarily, you know, go out of business or just kind of, I don't know. To me, they sort of shift the services. They don't necessarily replace them.
And they shift the services and you know, when you're talking about 2-minute arrival times versus, you know, anybody who, for example, you know, calls for a taxi, it takes a long time. So you can essentially become an independent contractor as a taxi driver and go through Uber and actually get paid more than you would through, you know, working, you know, as an employee of a typical, you know, taxi company. So, you know, for the worker or for the actual driver, you know, if you have your own car, you should be able to provide better service to the customer and actually get a higher wage by going through like an Uber or a Lyft than through a taxi company. So you can certainly see, you know, why, you know, taxi companies would lobby pretty heavily to, you know, try and, you know, push that competition out or at least keep it at bay.
Right. Well, and with the current kind of lobby or with the current taxi system, I mean, I know at least in Washington, D.C., for sure, they have these, you know, medallions that must be purchased in order to operate a cab. Mm. And this kind of Uber, Lyft type of thing basically does away with that, which cuts out the cost of medallions, which limits the competition for the taxi companies, but it also kind of cuts into how much money the actual drivers are able to make.
And the
I know in Milwaukee recently they lifted the limit on the number of taxi companies that like maximum number of taxis in the city. And I think kind of similar legislation should be following in other places as well.
Yeah. So it's an example of, I mean, it's an example of a free market solution that is owner operated versus, you know, owned by, you know, interests that are regulated by the, you know, by various local governments, and they get, you know, the local governments get a revenue. You know, if you're talking about medallions, they get, you know, an amount of revenue per medallion that, you know, that each driver gets. So it's, you know, it's kind of a dual threat between, you know, your taxi cab outfits and then also cities that derive revenue, but, you know, through licensing essentially. So you can see where, you know, there's
right. It really in my mind empowers the individual.
Yeah.
To
make
kind
more.
It empowers the individual. And I think another thing that is sort of as libertarians we can kind of mm-hmm. I don't know be on board with is this idea of regulation through this sort of evaluation process or review process, sort of
reputation,
a Yelp type of
reputation
based regulation mm-hmm. as opposed to government regulation or oversight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's to me there are industries that are threatened and they. You know, when you're talking about, you know, various sharing economy businesses or startups that are making significant progress, because I think Uber is now, their valuation is approaching $20 billion, they're a significant threat, as far as various transportation and taxi cab companies are concerned, but there's a reason for that. So you're going to get that pushback, but it doesn't, to me, it's why wouldn't you be, if you drive taxi full time, why wouldn't you take advantage of the opportunity to become an owner operator,
your own boss? Yeah.
An owner operator, have a higher wage, offer more responsive service, you know, when utilizing something like Uber than going through a company that essentially garnishes your wages to a certain extent. You don't get as much of a cut per fare. So why wouldn't you do that? So you can kind of, you know, you can kind of see the push and pull between the two, but, you know, in my mind, it's an inevitability. Of course, you have conflict over that, but it's a situation where the idea has probably been there for a long time, but now the technology is available to empower individuals who may have had there's probably individuals that thought about something like this 20, 30 years ago. It's probably nothing new, but now they can utilize it. So. Speaking of Airbnb and conflicts between established business interests and individuals, I have a Reason TV clip that goes over Airbnb's model. I'll go ahead and roll that here.
Would you ever be willing to stay on a couch for $10?
It depends if the couch is comfy.
I don't think I would, no.
No.
I mean, the income is a huge help. On average, we take half off our rent a month.
In New York City, there's a lot wrong with it because people have spent their entire lives here. I don't feel like they should have to pick up and move just because Airbnb wants to come in and make millions of dollars.
In New York City, the average hotel room costs almost $300 per night, which explains the growing popularity of a new way to stay over in the Big Apple. Increasingly, tourists are paying to sleep on someone's couch or guest bed while they're in town. Services like Flipkey, Roomarama, and Airbnb connect local residents that want to pick up some extra cash with out-of-towners who want to save on their visits. It's part of the sharing economy, a growing sector in which individuals directly trade goods and services of all sorts, from renting a stranger's car.
I just listed on the Relay Rides marketplace.
to getting a random person to help with chores.
You'll get a text or an email letting you know that your task is underway.
Airbnb, which is the most popular service connecting travelers with a place to stay, is an international phenomenon with accommodations in 192 countries. Travelers can stay in an igloo in Greenland, a teepee in Denmark, or a treehouse above San Francisco Bay. Lauren and Rob are both actors and musicians, and they live together in a one-bedroom on Manhattan's Upper West Side that costs $22.50 per month. They rent out their couch almost every night for $65.
We probably have about 5 requests per week.
Wow.
Yeah. We have an iSqueeze foot massager where people can rest their tired feet on the end of a long day.
So many people come to New York and don't realize how much walking they're going to be doing. So that's a nice amenity for them. I'm an actor, so basically unemployed is what I'm used to. So that's been helpful. But we've definitely met some cool people.
Airbnb has seen its global presence more than double in just this past year, which means that more than ever before, people all over the world are able to visit places like New York City when otherwise they might not have been able to afford to. You know, this place is $10. Is that something that would interest you?
Yeah, but the photo doesn't really look that attractive, to be honest.
What about something like this?
Yeah, that's more like it.
$10, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that is.
We're staying at the Marriott Marquis.
That's a really nice hotel. That's good. Is it expensive there?
It's quite pricey.
Would you ever consider staying in someone's apartment?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think I would, no.
No? Would you ever consider something like that?
Yeah.
But local governments are trying to either ban Airbnb or regulate it so much that it becomes almost impossible to participate. Bizarrely, Portland, Oregon prohibits Airbnb in all residential areas of the city, but allows it in industrial areas where permanent residents aren't allowed to live, just as long as there's off-street parking available and a 6-foot paved sidewalk between the building and the street. Austin, Texas allows residents to become Airbnb hosts just as long as they undergo a home inspection, purchase a $285 permit, and live in a neighborhood that hasn't already reached its quota.
Instructions for like how to operate the remotes and everything, because we have 3 remotes, so it can get a little confusing. Mm-hmm.
New York City allows hosts like Lauren and Rob to operate just as long as they're at home while their guest is staying there, and as long as the guest has open access to every room in their apartment, including their bedroom.
We have this curtain that we can put up so they can be separated.
But more than half of the listings for New York City don't meet these criteria. That's because Airbnb has collided head-on with one of the distinguishing facets of New York living, rent control. Sick of getting screwed, landlords who own rent-controlled apartments are foregoing the residential market and advertising their apartments on Airbnb as hotel rooms, which allows them to earn much more money.
No other city in the country has laws like we do here, which is really to protect tenants and to provide affordable housing.
Marty Weithman is a tenant advocacy lawyer who worked with the state legislature in the passage of a 2011 law that made it easier for the city to crack down on this practice.
If landlords want to rent through Airbnb and make more money, what would be wrong with that?
I mean, I don't think that there's anything wrong with that, but in New York City, there's a lot wrong with it because the laws on the books make that illegal.
Weithman says that when landlords rent their apartments to tourists for short-term stays, it serves as a way of driving out rent-controlled tenants who live in their buildings.
You have these tourists who are coming to the city and they're on vacation, right? So they're partying, they're up late at night, and sometimes people just can't take it anymore and they very well may just leave their homes because of all of that.
Do you think that would be a problem, that you know people can't afford to live here so they simply find a place where they can afford to live?
Maybe they have a job here, you know, and they're making a living here. Why should they be pushed to another state just because, again, Airbnb wants to come in and make millions of dollars?
But relying on the government to keep rental prices artificially cheap isn't the only way people of limited means can afford to stay in Manhattan.
I mean, the income is a huge help. On average, we take half off our rent. And so, it just takes the worry of money off.
Only if landlords, tenants, and tourists are allowed to work out amongst themselves the best way to make use of limited space will cities like New York become more affordable to live in or stay in. And services like Airbnb go a long way towards making that possible. For Reason TV, I'm Naomi Brockwell.
Wow, a Reason TV video I have not watched.
Well, now you've heard it.
Yeah, it was a good one. I enjoyed it. Interesting. To me, I'm just at the point where it's like, these things like, I don't know, rent control or getting the government involved. It's like, just in general, people being dependent on government to solve their problems. I'm just getting a little bit, I don't know, frustrated. But
why?
I don't know. Just like solve your own problems. I don't know why people need to get the government involved. But
right.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know if I've ever stayed in an Airbnb. Well, actually, no. We may have. We stayed in someone's home once, and we were in San Francisco several years ago. Interesting.
Yeah, but that's kind of the course that, I mean, it's kind of, if you look at Lyft or if you look at Uber or Airbnb or any other, what you could call quote unquote sharing economy company, it seems like at least to me, that one of the, most effective ways for established players to combat that is through government, right?
Of course. Yeah. That's where people turn. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they have, you know, they have resources and you know, you're endangering jobs and that type of thing. Or at least that's kind of the rhetoric that's used.
Right. Well, and it comes back to, I think a lot of it comes back to something we've talked about in previous podcasts, which is property rights and what you can do with your own property, whether it be your home, your vehicle, whatnot.
Mm. So I'm just kind of guessing, but I think if we look 5 years out, a lot of the, you know, sharing economy outfits, I mean, there are a lot of them that are competing now. You know, they'll be successful, and there'll be a lot of.
I think so.
A lot of individuals that will actually be better off because of that, who are employees too.
I think it empowers people to use things they already have. I mean, that's to me is one of the biggest or most attractive things about this kind of sharing economy thing is as someone who just hates to see waste or things wasted. This is an excellent way for people to kind of maximize the things that they have or things that may not be used to their full potential, by renting them out or sharing them with others. I think to me, that's one of the most appealing things is the I don't know, efficiency or, I'm trying to think of the word, utilizing things to the best of their potential, I guess.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're being efficient with your resources. You're making money off of what you can.
Yep.
Yeah. I think it's amazing what these guys are doing. They're definitely inspirational as far as what you can do with what you've got. I mean, to me, it hadn't really been considered like, hey, could I rent out my couch? Like, I'm like, there's no way I'd be able to rent out my couch. Maybe there's somebody out there who'd be willing to spend, you know, $20 a night to stay on my couch. And $20 a night, that's not great money, but that's okay. You know, it's not like you're losing a whole lot of money. You can only benefit by it, right? So
exactly. As people who support the free market, we can agree that any potential, you know, voluntary exchange that people are willing to partake in, they should be able to and is a good thing.
Yeah, well, you know, I can also understand, like, if somebody was renting out, like, a room in their home and, like, a whole group of people ended up coming and moving in next door who are, you know, very annoying people, but because of the way it was set up, that they were allowed to come and stay there. I can see, like, covenants and stuff like that coming into effect.
Yeah.
Just through, like, pure sympathy with the situation where somebody was dealing with a neighbor who was renting out their house and didn't care, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
That goes into the whole libertarian philosophy of you can do whatever you want as long as it doesn't affect me. And as soon as it starts to affect the other person, then you got to have a concern about it.
So. Right. And that kind of gets into property rights, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Sorry, what were we going to say, Eric?
There have been examples, loud,
obnoxious.
Loud, obnoxious guests staying in, you know, various apartments, houses, etc. Even using Airbnb to set up brothels in Europe, mm-hmm. where obviously that's not okay to do that, and that kind of, like you're saying, Lydia, that gets back to property rights, mm-hmm. where, you know, of course that's regulated, and it gets back to reputation too. You really, as an individual who rents out your property of any sort, you should really have the ability to filter, potential
guests,
individuals you're going to use your service, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And as reputational services get built out, if there's somebody who's looking to, rent your place through Airbnb or utilize your services through, Lyft or Uber, you can, as a owner operator, you can look at those individuals,
deny them service if you,
right.
Yeah, believe them to be, yeah.
Yeah. And as an individual is looking to, to utilize a service, you can judge the owner operator. So that, that type of thing, we're still kind of in early stages, but that,
right.
But that type of thing should flesh itself out.
I think so. Yeah.
And if you're an individual that, doesn't necessarily, vet whatever, if an owner who doesn't vet or a client who doesn't vet, then it's, it becomes, pretty
your
apparent.
Own risk.
Yeah. So, I think, as time goes on and really, why shouldn't you, even through Airbnb, if you own a property that's, close to another property, why shouldn't you even be aware of who's staying there and look at their reputation and rate their reputation? And, mm-hmm. There'd be ramifications behind, being loud and obnoxious in an apartment in New York City and that type of thing. So, to me, it just seems like that's a problem that will be worked out.
That can solve itself. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
Well, did you have any other clips on, B-Cycle, Eric, or?
I do have one on B-Cycle, and we can roll
that's
that.
One I know less about, but I'm kind of interested to hear the clip.
And especially since it's based out of Madison, so. Here we go.
Once upon a time, the automobile was the engine of American prosperity. It was the promise of freedom and independence, an icon of American values traveling the clean arteries of a new highway system. But times have changed, and the automobile hasn't. Today, transportation delays result in more than 1.4 billion gallons of wasted fuel and more than $9 billion in lost time annually. People who commute by car spend an average of 50 hours stuck in traffic each year. A single auto costs about $8,000 to fuel and maintain, uses about 500 gallons of gas, and produces about 10,000 pounds of CO2 annually.
Yawn.
What, yawn?
But we can think differently about what it means to be free and independent, about how we move through our cities and towns, about the simple pleasure of forward momentum the automobile once represented. And we can embrace a new kind of transportation, one that will unclog our roads, clean up our skies and bodies, and change the way we live. It's time for Plan B. Imagine a bike that's as simple and reliable as a wristwatch. One that never needs air in the tires or grease on the chain. One that you don't have to store or even own. Imagine a bike that's there when you need it, wherever you are, and gone when you don't. That's B-Cycle. But B-Cycle is more than a bike. It's a new American philosophy of going, and it addresses some of America's most pressing needs. Converting calories into gas, a bicycle gets the equivalent of 3,000 miles per gallon. The average person loses 13 pounds their first year commuting by bicycle. A 4-mile bicycle trip keeps about 15 pounds of pollutants out of the air we breathe. B-Cycle is good for you and good for the environment, but perhaps more important, B-Cycle is easy. And perhaps even more important than that, B-Cycle is fun. B-Cycles live in B-Stations. You can check them out just like library books. B-Cycles are free for the first half hour. To wake a B-Station up, just press the nice big button. The screen will tell you what to do next. Swipe your B-Connected card or credit card. The screen will show you which bicycles are available. Use the keypad to choose a B-Cycle. The screen will confirm your selection. You're all set. Grab a bike and go. Once you've gotten your B-Cycle, then what? Well, that's up to you. You are your own engine. Your journey is limited only by your imagination. Ride to work, ride to the market, take a spin to the gym, pedal with friends to a part of town you've never seen before and have tapas. You can return your B-Cycle to any empty slot in any B-Station. Rack it and billing stops, but the journey doesn't. You can use B-Cycles again and again because they're located in all the places you want to be. Solar-powered B-Stations are distributed throughout the city, next to train stations, bus terminals, social and work centers, and the places where people live. B-Cycle is part of your community. It's here today and it'll be here tomorrow. Simple and convenient as the open road, and destined to stay that way.
That'd be kind of a cool thing to check out, Lydia. I think, like, I've done the, ridden bicycles in Minneapolis, and they kind of.
The, like, nice ride type things?
Yeah, they take, like, $75 or 50 or 75 reserve off your credit card, and then you can, you know, if you keep it under a half hour, I think it's like $1.50.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that B-Cycle is kind of the same. And you know, in most cities, you know, you pretty much go anywhere you want within a half hour, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, it's efficient.
Well, and especially places like Madison and Minneapolis, which are incredibly bicycle friendly.
Yeah.
We happen to have, where I work, a B-Cycle station right across the street. And I was talking to, one of my coworkers had asked me if I'd done the B-Cycle, not knowing what it was. I responded, I have my own B-Cycle that I ride on my own time. I see quite a few people utilizing the service. So it's definitely something to check out. It's at least if it's free for a half hour.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's interesting. I really don't know a whole lot about it but yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I don't, as far as it's probably similar to
the thing I'm interested in knowing is because my perception of kind of the B-Cycle type thing is that it's got to be in some ways sort of government involved, and that, you know, they have the stations set up all over the city and how you get permit or access to set up a stand. You know what I mean?
I think it's actually owned. The permitting or where they are put is done by buying a private spot on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I know my company, who I work for, who will remain undisclosed at this time, but they have a major station right outside of the building that I work in, and that's guaranteed private property. They're a wealthy enough company that they definitely own the block that this is sitting on. So I'd be really surprised if that was totally government sponsored. I know that there is some initiatives out there that are helping sponsor the whole project, but I think where they're sitting is definitely a for-profit spot for those guys.
Interesting. I guess that would make sense. I just had never really considered it.
The thing for me, having been an employee of a company who works downtown for the last 3 years, I can walk to the far side of the city without any problem whatsoever. If I take an hour and 10 minute long lunch, I can go to a sit down restaurant on the far side of downtown from where I live. So like the whole riding the bike thing, like while it could decrease my total commute time, it really isn't worth it because I can just walk that distance instead.
True. Yeah. I mean, I know for me, I bicycle just about everywhere at this point. And it really does cut down on time. I mean, really with these kind of B-cycle stations, the thing is really, you know, how close or convenient are the located stations to where you're going. But, again, like I said earlier with kind of the Uber and the Airbnb, it's not to say that, B-cycles will replace people owning their own bicycles. That's
fair
for
enough.
Sure. You know, the two systems kind of coexist. So, you know, you're not going to have people exclusively giving people rides in their car or people exclusively going on vacation and staying in other people's homes. I don't think you'll have people exclusively borrowing bicycles, but as people who support a free market, I think this is certainly an alternative option for people who don't want to own their own bicycle or maintain their own bicycle, but would like the option of quickly going from one place to another without paying for a bus or a taxi or that kind of thing. So I think it's
right.
Somewhat slightly less, or at least it's on, at least with, in terms of buses, it's more of your own convenience.
Right, for sure. Yeah, I appreciate what they're doing. I just haven't personally found motivation to hop on that bike up until this point. I'm sure that there's a lot of circumstances where people who use them, they really appreciate it. Now, what I've heard is the bikes are really heavy. They've got...
Yeah, that's what I've noticed as well. They're very thick.
They're thick.
Okay.
And they don't have, and you know, you have just a few. It's not a 12-speed bike, right? They have like the baskets and.
Yeah.
So it's like a 3-speed bike overall, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So it's heavy, but it's got, you know, it's got what you need to be able to get around. And the nice part about Minneapolis, actually, which makes that even better, is that it's a really flat city. You're not talking about.
Yeah. Yep.
Booking it up any hills or anything.
Right.
I think it would be really nice to see like a little bit more control over educating people on what the bike lane means, meaning stop riding the wrong way against the flow of traffic, because I see a lot of that, which is really dangerous.
But a lot of those people are probably messengers, right?
Well, the people I see doing it are typically the people on those bikes Yeah, not actually messengers. A lot of the messengers fly around wherever they want to go.
I know. They're like kamikaze.
Yeah, basically. I guess I've seen a few acting as a salmon every now and then, but not as many as I do. Like, just people, just random people on their own bikes who, like, are willing to hop up on the sidewalk and, like, pull over people and keep riding like that. Mm. So.
Yeah, so, you know, when looking at the various services. I mean, if you look at B-Cycle, it's free under 30 minutes, a buck for under an hour, $4 every hour over that. You look at Uber, you pay a bit of a premium, but you get efficient, quick service. Airbnb, you don't pay a premium, you get better value, and they, you know, they're obviously, since it's a newer type of way of doing things, you have issues, people being too loud, upsetting neighbors, trashing places, but as time goes on, you know, those issues can be taken care of, you know, with reputational feedback, and you know, you certainly can get better value by a lot of times, you know, just renting from someone who owns a unit rather than a hotel. But you don't get some of the amenities that you get in hotels. But
right,
yeah. But you know, with all those services, it seems, you know, just makes sense. And I would be really surprised if they don't get more and more popular as time goes on.
Right.
But at the same time, gonna have some pushback from established companies in those areas, but should be a net positive, I think,
yeah.
Overall.
I think, am I interrupting?
Nope, I'm done.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, it sounds like we're starting to play some jazzy music, so it seems like we're kind of starting to wrap it up.
Yeah.
I think for me at least, these different applications, Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, B-Cycle, are all about something that we as sort of the liberty movement as a whole can kind of embrace, which is choice, and which I think is really natural to people just in general. And I think through technology and new applications and innovations via the free market, more choice in transportation, more choice in travel, more choice in a variety of things offers people, you know, a greater selection, better prices, a more customized or optimal choice or selection. So I think kind of on the whole, these services over time will become appealing to people in their expansion of choice and will just kind of expose government protectionism and regulations as being more antiquated and in the way of people's choice.
May the free market bear true.
And I think, you know, quality of service will improve as well.
I think so too. Yep.
Yeah, and that's really one of the big factors when you're looking at
choice.
At the free market and choice in general. So
yep, absolutely.
All right, Matt.
All right, folks. This has been Liberty Southwest podcast number 23. Thanks for joining us. This has been Eric Taylor, Lydia Tabbitt, and Matt Winter. Thanks a lot.